Chapter 10.
Ideality, reality. If a worker in God's vineyard fulfills his task properly in this world, under no condition may he lose sight of reality. He will continuously live and struggle with the constant awareness that he must never lose himself entirely in ideality and thus break connection with reality. For when a seeker of the light is looking for his reality in ideality, he loses his strength. His dynamic, growing, regenerating faculty is broken, and he becomes completely ineffective against people, groups, and powers who are interested in maintaining a certain unholy reality. Imagine that your dynamism, your talents, and your love for mankind were great enough to be dangerous for certain devilish powers, then these powers, using ancient methods, would try to bring about your downfall. They would take advantage of your lower nature, of your self-maintenance, of various dialectical delusions, which may confuse you. They would try by bringing about all sorts of tensions and disharmony in your working field to divert your energy or to degrade it. All workers of importance have experienced this. If these methods, which, alas, in general, prove very successful, do not work, and if the worker with God's help remains standing in spite of all those snares and ruses, they try to drown him in ideality, where the inferior power supports his work and seems to cooperate with him entirely. The way this method works is very simple, so simple that its very simplicity shows its sinister craftiness. Ideality, namely, represents a great purity, a truth, which is almost irrefutable, whereas reality generally confronts and connects us with impurity. Therefore, ideally considered, it is a matter of course that he who hankers after the light draws back from impurity will have nothing to do with it, makes himself sterile against this impurity, and that his whole being, his whole striving, his whole spiritual potentiality will be directed to and used for purity, the axiom of ideality. But such a man will then actually stand beside the world and live in a world of phantoms. The esoteric student also aspires after the divine order of things. His whole attitude is directed to break away from the grasp of nature so that he may find the secret communication with God. Are we therefore not obliged to make our reality out of ideality? Is Christ true or is he not? He shows us a kingdom not of this world. All right, seek then the kingdom of Christ. Phantoms, devilish ruse, no man who is seeking his reality in ideality has ever been able throughout world history to stop the triumphal chariot of the devilish powers in its course for one single second. The mystic value of idealism is impotent in this world. But what about the magic aspect? Can we not, as pupils of the spiritual school with our collective magic potentiality, attack and overcome impurity out of purity? Is this not what the universal brotherhood expects of us? What about the words of Christ? Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of you. Indeed, this is quite simple according to the literal text, but as such, completely impotent. He who, as a servant of the light, suffers himself to be denaturized in this way is the victim of a devilish ruse. Therefore, if you can see through this effort, when this temptation one day confronts you, whether through an enemy or a congenial friend, say, Satan, get thee behind me. This temptation will come to every worker and aspirant in this world. Attempts are constantly made to render you impotent by submerging you in ideality. This temptation has always been recognized by the Rosy Cross through the centuries. Knowing ideality, it will only approach it through reality. This path entails very difficult consequences, and we believe that if one refuses to go this path, there can be no question of Christianity. We strongly feel the necessity for you to know about these things because in the coming times, pressure will be put on us from all sides in order to prevent us from doing the work we have to do together, or to incite us to do things we should not do. The reality in which we live, in which we exist, is extremely impure, mutilated and broken, and no longer possesses any harmonious relationship with ideality, i.e. the perception we have received from the reality which is with Christ and from Christ. Ideality is not a power nor an absolutely independent state of being, but it is a certain radiation of light through which we become conscious of another reality, that of Christ. The radiation of light of ideality does nothing in itself. It does not change anything within us. It is radiating over us and over all mankind. We only become conscious of this radiation when, living in the impure reality, we experience resistance, like pain, grief, sadness, when we experience the defectiveness of this nature with regard to our own being. Then we may become conscious of this radiation. It shows us another reality which is pure and harmonious. However, although the delight of the radiation of ideality itself may be consoling and may give us relief, and although it may give the mystic food and warmth, it does not change reality at all. We remain of this nature, and we remain part of its defectiveness without any uplifting. When we are absorbed in ideality only, we become a dark spot in the radiation of Christ, a sun spot, and we thereby weaken the radiation. If we say in our delusion, "As I have now seen the radiation of the light of Christ and have received its consolation and warmth, I do not want to have anything more to do with the impure nature," we deceive ourselves because we are part of this impurity. We are not only living in it, and we know that we are not only surrounded by impurity, but we are, by body and blood, a part of this nature order, of its defectiveness. At best, there is a certain focus in which and by which the radiation of purity, touching you, awakens a certain remembrance of a lost father house. Therefore, we cannot flee. We can only have two reactions. Either we dream a phantom of a new reality by narcotizing ourselves with ideality, or we use the broken reality which we are and in which we are living in a process of regeneration. Therefore, with both legs planted firmly in reality, we must attack our defective nature, and immediately great and difficult problems arise. How should we work? How can anything impure purify and regenerate the impure? Is that possible at all? According to which design do we have to work then? We give ourselves different guidelines corresponding with the degree of enlightenment of our consciousness which we experience through the Christ radiation. But is this enlightenment really sufficient? Is our guidelines a pure one? Is the consciousness sufficient to draw a pure guideline? Do we possess the organ to receive the pure truth, even if it is only a small part? When we want to do good, are we not perhaps doing evil? We realize here our complete dependence and impotence. We then experience a wonder and an inconceivable work of charity. The light does not only give off a radiation in order to enlighten and instruct our consciousness, but the light descends, breaks in, into our defectiveness and impurity. A personal contact develops in our being, so that we can overcome our weakness and impotence in this power. Do we fully realize what Christ and all the members of his hierarchy are doing for us? They link themselves in substance and in essence, as the body and blood, with the impurity, in order to effect the great aim, the salvation of mankind. They consider the glory with the Father insignificant in order to become one of us. They bear the disgrace of the impurity because of the great and holy aim. They descend into the sewer. Think in this connection of the well-known play The Servant in the House by Charles R. Kennedy, in which one of the main characters says that he is a sewerman to clear the dirt of the world, and thereby opposes the Bishop of Lancashire, who is entirely lost in dreams. The serene and pure light powers descend into the sewer of impurity not with the heroism of dialectics to clear the impurity with the fire of their pureness, but they become one of us, in order to establish from beneath the eternity in time. They become one of us, and how? Not as Superman, who looks down on human bungling, but they cooperate with the state of consciousness of the masses, within the scope and with the methods of the masses, in order to have mankind find its own limits and to make the blood susceptible to higher reality. This procedure is not without pain. The Gospels bear witness to it. When the Son of Man comes to earth, he does not find faith there. Why not? Because of the people's consciousness and the subjection to their blood. Even his disciples cannot understand him. Why not? Because of their consciousness and the subjection of their blood, because of their impurity. What is he doing then? He does not give any doctrine, and if he does, it is only a confirmation of former manifestations of the light. He gives a power to those who can work with it, and he leads the processes of dialectics from beneath, and thus he is the worker in the sewer. He becomes the servant of all men. He becomes one who serves. He fulfills the law and the prophets, which means that man can only seize the aspect of redemption which is in Christ through the law. The law states, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The doctrine of redemption, however, says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The man who looks upon ideality wants to dissolve the law. He wants to be liberated from an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And he tries to maintain what he thinks is a neighborly love, but he fails and has no results. According to our ideality and to our experience, we detest the an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But at the same time, we realize that as long as mankind remains in its present state, the law of revenge will be maintained. The light of the higher law cannot be seized and understood until the law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth has come to its logical end, so that in and by the irrevocable end, mankind screaming in pain may find its way to higher life. The law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is a divine law, just as the higher law that the spiritual order of Jesus Christ gives us. This lower divine law is secured through all times in all holy scriptures. The law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth must therefore be fulfilled according to nature, as we ourselves are of this nature. But even when we are personally free from this nature, we shall, as members of the hierarchy, help to increase the potentiality of the fulfillment of the lower law. Out of love for mankind, and because of our connection with mankind, what we want to say is that if we recognize the endeavors of Christ in this nature, we discover an increase of the potentiality which fulfills the law. With an ever-increasing speed, mankind is driven to an inevitable end, to its fulfillment. What formerly could not be accomplished in 100 years is now fulfilled in 1 year. The reason? The increase of the potentiality which fulfills the law. The servants of Jesus Christ are not fleeing from this world, but they are fulfilling the law. This does not mean abiding by the law, but intensifying the law, development of the law of this nature, so that this nature reaches its limit. Do we have to take it that the hierarchy of Christ has caused the last war? Of course not. It is a scientific urge to a solution that cannot be prevented or may not be prevented anymore. Think of Judas. The Christ urged Judas to execute his deed during the night. Did Christ then drive Judas to his deed in the sense of causing it? Did he approve? Of course not. Offenses must come, but woe the men by whom the offenses come. But right through the offenses, in the full sense of the word, the redemption can be born. The hierarchy of Christ increases the speed of the offenses in order to make the redemption a fact. Summarizing, we arrive at the following conclusion. There are two domains, two orders of nature, one of dialectics and one of statics, the future domain of life. Both domains have their own law, their own system, to manage tensions and powers. It may furthermore be stated about both orders of nature that their law is a divine law, although the law of dialectics is a lower law in comparison with the one of the static world, the higher law. In addition, we must add that our domain of life is a limited one, as we are living here, incidentally. That is why man must learn that he is called to a higher life, to the life of the immovable kingdom, why he must be liberated from his prison. Therefore, Christ breaks into our domain of life in order to render the way to the immovable kingdom possible. He makes the higher law light up before our consciousness so that we may receive in this light the necessary guidelines for our orientation. Therefore, Christ primarily explores a way for us. That is the first thing. Thereupon, mankind, incidentally connected with the order of this nature, must be liberated from it. With vigilance, this process must be suffered through, struggled through, not with regard to the higher law, but to the lower law, as mankind is from the lower law. This lower law must therefore be fulfilled, must be intensified, urged on, as the only possibility for further redemption. This is the truth about the work of redemption. Thus, man is not lifted up out of nature, for that is not possible. He is led through nature by means of the fulfillment of the law of this nature. Thus, he grows to maturity for the ascent of the third phase of redemption, for the true new life. In the first phase, Christ Jesus is the divine man who descends into the pit of perdition, the shining sinless man who, from the serene sphere of the immovable kingdom, comes to reveal to us the way, safeguards this way through his blood sacrifice. In the second phase, the Christ is the realist who chases mankind through the sewer of passions according to the law, so that man will become purified and matured for the assimilation of the divine substance of life. In the third phase, the Christ is the path and thereby life itself. The mystic Freemasonry of the Rosy Cross is completely in harmony with this threefold realism. Therefore, we always meet the mystic Rosy Cross on the way. Therefore, we meet the realistic Rosy Cross in the processes of the inevitable truth. And therefore, we meet the Hierophants of the Rosy Cross on the path of the true life. Finally, grasp the following concept as the central guidance in the life of a servant of the Rosy Cross. It is not for love to hold mankind back from nature, but for its redeeming power to hurry it through nature, for through nature we shall meet the Spirit.